This is The Daily Circuit. I'm Tom Weber. A conversation now about living off the land. It just sounds romantic, doesn't it? The idea has gotten quite the bump of late with the contingent of those taking up the causes of urban gardening, organic produce, caring for chickens or bees or goats or something else in your backyard. Keep in mind, though, this isn't a trend. It's actually in the top five among the first things humans ever did. And it's not all glamour. As author David Troyer notes, Indian country is known for generations of living off the land, but it's often portrayed as a thing Native Americans do to maintain an important cultural link to the past. But it is actually a necessity for some, and David Troyer ponders the future of living off the land in an article that he wrote for this month's Harper's Magazine. Troyer's books include Res Life. He grew up on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota and joins me now. David, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
I'm glad you're here. I'm also joined by Dennis Jones, a former Ojibwe language professor at the University of Minnesota, who now runs an Ojibwe language immersion camp in Ontario that actually gets into this conversation about living off the land as well. So, David, thank you for being here.
Yeah, it's Dennis. I'm glad to be here,
Dennis. Yeah. Sorry about that. David and Dennis we have.
I do want to be like David, though.
David and Dennis. Your questions in this conversation as you listen along, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at WeberTom1, and please don't call or text if you're driving. So, David, this, in many ways, for this particular article, was simply going home, a trip home. But what were you trying to explore and discover here?
Well, I first started noticing a lot more, many more books and articles and blogs and so on about living off the land in the wake of the economic crisis around 2008. Mm-hmm. And people portrayed living off the land, going back to nature, as some sort of return to some original state, a state of nature as opposed to a state of man. And I started asking myself, well, is it really like that? Is that how it really is? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write about it. And what I discovered when I was writing about it is that it's not as romantic as it seems, and that for people who actually make a living taking things from nature, living off the land is as much living in markets as it is living among trees or animals and the like.
That doesn't jive with the breath of fresh air we all think about when we think about living off the land,
well,
right?
No, I mean, people think, you know, people have this very romantic idea about living in some nicely appointed cabin on a mountainside and walking up at dawn and shooting a beautiful elk and bringing it back and using all the parts and leaving all the evils of culture and civilization behind. But what I discovered and what I've always felt in a way is that it's only by being parts of a civilization or a culture that we can actually survive in nature, mm-hmm. that we bring with us all the things that that culture provides, whether it's an understanding of weather, whether it's how to prepare an animal to eat it, or even a match or a knife or a coat,
yeah.
or leather boots or a down jacket. All those things come from a culture or many cultures, and from civilization.
But that it also, subsistence, as you note in the article, isn't also just about making sure we don't lose every last vestige of Native American culture.
No. Well, you know, in a place like Leech Lake, unemployment runs about 60%. And people don't have what we think of as regular employment. It doesn't exist up there. And what a lot of people do to make ends meet is to go out and forage. They forage pine cones, and those are sold. They trap furs, and those are sold. They cut balsam boughs for wreaths, hanging on many people's doors right now. Mm-hmm. Those were harvested by Indian people who then sell them to wreath makers, and the wreath makers make wreaths and sell them to the Home Depot and to Walmart and Kmart and everywhere else. So people go out and harvest, and then that stuff is sold. And they do this to make ends meet, but it's also something that maybe their parents did or grandparents did. So for them, it's two things. It's a way of putting money in their pockets. It's also a way of being out in the woods and using the land that remains to us now.
We talk so much, David, about the conversations now being had about where your milk comes from, where your food comes from, where this comes from. But where does your Christmas wreath come from?
Right.
I'd never thought of that.
Yeah. And in fact, the Christmas tree that's sitting at the Capitol.
Right, the state capital. Well, both capitals, actually.
Yeah, in Washington, D.C. came from Cass Lake. It came from Leech Lake Reservation. That's our tree.
It is your tree. Dennis, get in here, because this you were mentioning before the show that, that part of what David is talking about has also been your dream to see that through. Say more about that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I ran an Ojibwe language immersion camp, Language and Culture, up in Ontario. And the community is called Nigigamos Minikaning First Nation. And we started our camp back in 85 and ran around the state showing everybody how to run an immersion camp. And then my brother and I, my twin brother and I, in 1995 decided to make a home for it on the Nigigamos Minikaning First Nation. And we've been running our camp since 95, and all throughout my teaching career, I've been bringing students up there. I organized different language immersion camps for classrooms for students that are taking Ojibwe language immersion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the living off the land kind of subsistence element to it is also a part of that camp.
Right, right. Living off the land, yeah. So in my family, we're born and raised living off the land. So it was just natural for us to try and teach others how to do it.
Is it done, though, with a nod to kind of preserving culture, as you hear a lot when these kinds of conversations are had? Or is it really more about, you know, this is actually like a business school. We're actually trying to develop almost an economic model. And David gets into that in the article. Mm.
That's a good question.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. What a great idea. There's money in this.
Well, that's actually, David, what you got into, this concept that it's once you get past the romanticism and the fact that there are bugs when you go out in the woods and things like that, but you ponder the economics of this as
right.
well.
I mean, and Dennis mm-hmm. and I were talking about this before we came in, that for him, for me too, you know, going back and learning to do things that maybe we didn't pick up as kids for whatever reason. Dennis grew up on a trap line. He grew up with parents, both of whom made a significant portion of their income from trapping. And I didn't. Mm-hmm. And so it was actually in the mid-90s, around 95, when Dennis's brother Dan said to me, "Hey, David, you ever want to learn how to trap?" I've never trapped in my life. And I said, "Yeah, I'd like that a lot." He said, "Well, I'll teach you." And for me, it was very much about reconnecting to the kinds of things that my family had done for generations, but that I didn't do much of, and I hadn't grown up doing those things. So it was about culture and about reconnection. It's also about economics. I mean, I make my living as a writer and as a professor. I don't make my living as a trapper or a bow picker or a pinecone picker or a wild rice harvester, mm-hmm. etc. I do those things because they bring me pleasure. I like being in the woods. It connects me to my cultural patrimony. I don't do them to make a living. I'm not good enough at those things to make a living at it. Some people are, but yeah. You have to be very good at it. So Dennis was saying that for him, right, that it's a lot about reconnecting your students to the ways that their ancestors lived, and that's really important.
Right, yeah. So it's a form of spirituality. Traditional subsistence practices is like... cultural identity, spiritual identity, spiritual subsistence, these are considered spiritual occupations because of the way that they're treated. So we have ceremony before we do wild rice, for example, ceremony before we pick blueberries. We do the ceremonial aspect of it. I grew up with a father that was very ceremonially oriented. In fact, our whole community would come to our house just for my father to do ceremony. So there's that spiritual subsistence practice aspect of it. So it's a whole lifestyle and just...
It almost also seems like an extension of the work you did at the U, trying to make sure the Ojibwe language didn't die out.
Right. So when I started my teaching career, I asked my elders, what kind of curriculum should I develop? What should I teach about? And they said, teach about things off the land. So I developed the wild rice unit. I developed things that people want to learn about. And yeah, and that was it.
Dennis Jones is with us, a former Ojibwe language professor at the U, and David Troyer, a writer who has an article in this month's Harper's Magazine. We've linked to it at our website as well at mprnews.org. You can read all about it, about living off the land. He does it through the spectrum of his own Leech Lake Reservation, where he grew up in northern Minnesota. And I'll just read one little passage here. "The Indian way of life and activities like hunting and gathering that are coded as Indian are healthier and more sustainable. What I hear in these narratives is the persistent notion that American Indians and our associated lifestyle are not just more authentic or noble, but more practice. Meanwhile, things at Leech Lake are not so bucolic. Subsistence living off the land is a way of life for many, though it doesn't look that way the way it does in popular imagination. It almost seems, David, that the structures we have set up kind of in society to measure things like having a job, having a living, don't really have a way to account for what's happening here that you talk about in the article.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned 60% unemployment.
Right.
Leech Lake. Well, is it really 60%, or is 10% of that people who actually live off the land and you can't measure that as well?
I tried to find out, and I talked to people who buy pine cones and buy boughs and things like that. And it seems like there are fewer and fewer people doing – fewer and fewer native folk doing those things back home at Leech Lake. Mm-hmm. There were fewer pine cone pickers. And I remember being a kid, that's one thing we did do. We'd be complaining. I'd say, Mom, I need some money. I want to buy some Legos. I want to – whatever. And she said, if you want some money, it's laying around on the ground outside the house. And you can go pick it up off the ground if you want to, but I'm not giving you any. And so then she brought us out there and we picked pine cones. My brother and I would carry a big wash tub out in the woods and we'd pick white pine cones and we'd sell them, I think at that time, for something like $5 a bushel, which to me was a lot of money. And so, but there are fewer kids doing that. And that's one of the people I talked to for the article is a guy, my uncle, Bob Matthews, who makes a very good living off the land, but he is one of the most brilliant, hardworking, creative people I've ever met. He's found a way to make a very good, stable living, but nobody I know works as hard as he does.
But his bedroom for a few months of the year is filled with tree bark.
Yeah, cranberry bark. That's another market.
Tell me more about Bobby Matthews, because his story is the center, the crux of this article.
Yeah, he's really successful at living off the land, and he's one of the pleasures of being a writer and writing things like this is getting to spend time with people you really admire. And Bobby is one of the people I admire the most, and I always have ever since I was a little kid. And he always finds ways to compete in a market, say, as collecting leeches. Okay, how do I do this in a way that's the most efficient and I can beat out the competition? Because he's not the only person harvesting leeches or bark or boughs or cones or whatever. And then he says, once I have that competition beat, I'm competing with myself. How can I do better? How can I be more efficient? How can I increase my yield from last year, last season? And so he's always finding very creative ways to problem solve. I mean, they're really simple things. He was telling me once, he used to trap minnows. Of course, when you sell minnows, they have to be sorted. You have to sell them. You sell chubs and shiners and rainbows. They're all different species of minnows. And sorting minnows is tedious and time-consuming. The more time you spend sorting them, the less time you have to trap them. So he said, yeah, I realized that rainbows, for instance, if you put a light near the tank, they'll jump toward the light. It's just this weird thing they do. They jump toward the light. He said, so I divided my tank in half, and I put a piece of plexiglass in half the tank, and I put a light on the other half, and all the rainbows jumped to one side of the tank. And they sorted themselves.
Yeah.
And I saved myself 10 hours.
And when we say living off the land, this is on the profession side of life.
That's on the professional side.
Because you still have – he still has electricity, right? He has running water. It's not like he's not Walden Pond here.
Yeah, he's not living in a teepee on the shore of some lake chomping ice to get water. He's got, you know, he when he's peeling bark, he's watching Discovery Channel at the same time on his nice TV in his comfortable living room in his nicely warmed house.
Dennis, why do you think that there are fewer people doing what Bob Matthews are doing and doing what you're trying to do at your camp? Why would you think?
Well, you know, our camp doesn't have any running water or electricity. That's intentional.
So you are living off the land there.
Whenever our definition of running water is going down to the lake and running for some water.
Running for some water.
Running to the water.
You do have solar panels.
We do have solar energy, yeah. And trying to live off the grid. And so that's interesting too.
But in your quest to, when you were an instructor with the U, in your quest to make sure that the young people in your First Nation embrace the language of their elders, for example, you know, and the vigor to which you did that, do you have the same vigor for trying to impart this kind of hunting and gathering element to the culture as well?
Well, you know, technology, electricity, all of that are distractions to learning language and culture. So we intentionally do not have any of that out there. And in fact, we check it when they go, when they come out on a canoe trip. And we, before they have to paddle for 2 hours to get out to our camp, and they make that transition. And we come from a really lifestyle that is heavy and busy, and to one that's more light and tranquil. So they, that 2 hour paddle is a transition into a different lifestyle. So there's no technology. They can't bring it out there.
Dennis Jones and David Troyer are with me here today as we ponder and talk about an article David had in this month's Harper's Magazine about living off the land with respect to the Leech Lake Reservation, where he grew up in northern Minnesota. Your questions and thoughts here this morning, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at WeberTom1. And the reason I was interested in this article, David, is because you weren't trying to be quaint. This wasn't just a, hey, look at Bob Matthews. Isn't this an interesting fellow? Although that's definitely in there. I mean, you really do ponder this question of whether this could be a bigger thing, whether more people couldn't do this, and this couldn't be something that maybe one day helped with some of the ills at Leech Lake and other tribal nations.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dilemma. It's that subsistence as practiced by people like Bob Matthews, where you harvest things from the ground and you sell them at market, basically. I mean, it's a subsistence market. It's not just a subsistence lifestyle. It's both. But it's not something that everyone can do, because there wouldn't be any pine cones left. There wouldn't be any boughs on any of our balsam trees. There wouldn't be any beavers in the lakes. And we've done that before. Back during the fur trade, the Ojibwe people helped the colonial powers drive the beaver to near extinction. That was in part our doing as well. That's not sustainable. So it's not something that everyone can do at the same time. Only a few people can do it. So that's the dilemma. On one hand, it's really wonderful to bring people back into the kinds of things that our forefathers have done. But because it sort of breaks a cycle of dependency. And it creates and this is something that Dennis I've seen do with his students. He shows them how to sort of break the cycle of dependency on the products of, you know, mainstream society, but also on the kind of ways in which in Native communities we've been taught to be dependent on the social safety nets, on public assistance, and on many things. And knowing that you can go out and you've learned how to harvest wild rice. And if you work very hard over the span of a week or two, you're going to have enough rice to sustain you for a year. And that in part breaks a cycle of dependency, which is really wonderful. So on one hand, that's really great. On the other, Ojibwe life prior to the coming of, you know, the British and the French and finally the Americans was feast or famine. There was high mortality. The starvation was a reality. A high infant mortality. People died young. We didn't have hospitals. We didn't live as long as we do now. So when I think, what do I want for my kids? You know, I've got three children. I said, what do I want for them? I want them both to be in touch with this sort of the place and the activities that are rooted in that place that make them who they are. But I want them to always be warm and comfortable and to have good medical care and never to go hungry. And and that kind of means having a job.
But do you want them to know how to trap or know how to harvest wild rice for the sake of doing it once a year? Or do you like the idea of them jumping in with both feet at some point, even if it's just for a little bit?
Both. I mean, there's a kind of, I like the idea that our family gathers around harvest. and our family does do this. We gathered at harvest to tap maple trees in the spring. We gather to hunt in the fall. We don't gather to harvest wild rice as much because it coincides with the beginning of the academic year, which is very hard for kids and for people who are professors and teachers.
And it's also just hard to do.
What, rice?
To rice.
Yeah, but I took them this year, and they really enjoyed it. Some of my children more than others. And
we don't have to name them.
Yeah, but they were sort of impressed that they saw their food hanging over the water.
Yeah.
And then they knocked it in the canoe. And then we roasted it, and we jigged it, and we winnowed it. And then all of a sudden, they're staring at their next meal, and they're holding it in their hands. And my daughter says, wow, this is one dinner. How many dinners do you think we have in this bag? I said, we probably have about 50 dinners in here.
Hmm.
And she said, 50 dinners? I said, yeah, and you made that. She was really impressed. Mm-hmm. I would love at some point, were it at all possible, to take them out of school and bring them for a year and bring them through the whole cycle of seasons.
Yeah.
I think that's rather romantic. Practically, I don't know that will happen. Yeah. I hope it does.
Well, and you talk about how Bob Matthews, one month he's doing leeches, the next month it's bark from the cranberry bush.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's very seasonal. So you
just
have to be.
It's kind of great.
Back and forth. Yeah. Dennis, what would you do to that?
The aspect that we, my take on that is the food that grows on water is in our prophecies, and we were told to migrate from the East Coast and to find the food that grows on water. Geographically, where the Ojibwe people live is where wild rice grows. So I teach about that aspect of our culture, our history, and why we pick wild rice, for that matter. Yeah.
Dennis Jones is with us, a former Ojibwe language professor at the University of Minnesota, now runs a language immersion camp in Ontario that teaches both the language and some of these tactics for living off the land. David Troyer's new piece in Harper's Magazine, we've linked to on our website as well, mprnews.org. Your questions or comments here, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. We'll get to those calls and more conversation. First, though, a check of the hour's news with Stephen John. Good morning, Stephen.
Tom, weather is providing pre-Thanksgiving travel challenges in the upper Midwest into the northeastern U.S. Up to 10 inches of snow is predicted for parts of southern Minnesota by late today. Meanwhile, a storm is bringing rain and snow to the east coast, causing more than 200 flights to be canceled by this morning. Cleveland police plan to release the names of the two officers involved in the shooting death of a 12-year-old boy, along with dispatch calls and a surveillance video that authorities say clearly shows what happened on Saturday. The evidence and names will be made public at a briefing this afternoon. Tamir Rice died at a hospital Sunday after being shot by an officer who had responded to a call about someone with a gun at a Cleveland playground. It turned out to be an airsoft gun, which shoots small plastic pellets. In Ferguson, Missouri, overnight National Guard reinforcements helped contain additional protests over a grand jury's decision not to indict a white police officer in the shooting death of an unarmed black man. While the chaos of Monday night wasn't repeated last night, officers still used some tear gas and pepper spray. Demonstrators set a squad car on fire and broke windows at City Hall. 44 people were arrested. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had a stent implanted to clear an artery blockage. A court spokesperson says the 81-year-old Ginsburg had the procedure this morning after a coronary blockage was discovered. Ginsburg is expected to leave the hospital in the next 48 hours. Winter weather advisory for much of southern Minnesota today, including the Twin Cities. There is a winter storm warning for far south central Minnesota. This is NPR News.
Later on All Things Considered, a visit to North Dakota's state-owned flour mill, which will soon be the largest wheat grinding facility in the country. I'm Tom Crane. We'll have that story and all the day's news. Join me on Minnesota Public Radio News starting at 3.
Coming up on NPR News Presents, a broadcast from the Westminster Town Hall Forum featuring Brian Stevenson talking about ways to eliminate racial bias in the criminal justice system. That's at noon.
Programming is supported by Animal Humane Society, finding loving homes for thousands of animals every year. As year-end approaches, you can find out how to make a difference at animalhumanesociety.org.
Support for this program comes from Associated Bank, where you can email, live chat, tweet, or call their local service center to speak with an Associated Banker 24/7, 365. You can learn more about Associated Bank at associatedbank.com. Member FDIC.
This is The Daily Circuit. I'm Tom Weber. We're talking this hour with David Troyer and Dennis Jones, a conversation built around an article David wrote for Harper's Magazine about living off the land. And we're diving into that. David grew up on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. And you were just there, in fact. So you spent some time. Did you see Bobby while you were home?
I did, briefly.
How's he doing?
He's doing great.
What's he doing now? Is it leeches?
He takes off. He doesn't go in the woods and do anything during the state firearm season because there's a lot of crazy people in the woods with guns during the state
that makes
deer
sense.
Firearm season.
That makes sense.
So he pulls out of the woods when the season starts, and then he hunts deer himself, and then he puts back in after the season's over and starts setting snares and traps and starts trapping.
What is he trapping? Everything?
He likes trapping fox and bobcat, he says, is sort of his favorite. Mm. And I think he's going to set some stuff for those.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Chris, who is on the phone. Good morning, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Your thoughts here this morning.
We're currently in Stuart, Minnesota. We have family here, but we have been living in the state of Alaska up in Talkeetna for 12 and a half years, living off the land, off the grid. And we put a well in solar system, 2,080-watt solar system. We have a 1,000-watt wind generator. We hauled water for 2 years before we put the well in. And we grow 80% of our food. Wow. An abundance of food. We take it into the village of Talkeetna and sell it.
That's great.
So we've been living off the land. We have our own snowblower to clear our 3/4-mile driveway. We built our house in the middle of the woods. We bought a sawmill. We mill our own lumber.
Can we come stay?
Yeah. Let's all head to Alaska, Chris. We can come visit you. I'm
we
glad
you're...
Visit.
Not for everybody, though. I mean, you're either going to make it the first year or you're not.
Well, that's
pretty
that,
tough up there.
Yeah, and Chris, I'm glad you said that, because that's something that came up, David, when you talked specifically about leeches and harvesting leeches, which I would have never thought about. How many gas stations in northern Minnesota have I been in where there's bait right there, right?
Most of them.
Never have thought about the fact that someone goes out and actually gets them. And you set traps for leeches.
Yeah.
But it's hard. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's hard like any industry.
Well, that's how Leech Lake got its name, wasn't it?
From leech trapping?
Yeah, from the abundance of leeches.
That's what some people say, yeah. Or that the arms on the lake look like leeches themselves. I've heard both.
Oh.
But like any kind of industry, like any kind of profession, mm-hmm. There's competition within that profession.
Mm-hmm.
And there's... Each profession presents its own difficulties. So, you know, leeching is not easy. You keep really hard hours. It's physically demanding. Mm-hmm. It takes, and to be consistent.
Yeah.
To go out and throw something in a lake and get a few leeches back, fine. But to throw many traps in many lakes.
Hundreds.
Thousands.
Your Uncle Bob.
Thousands.
Thousands of traps. Mm-hmm.
In many lakes, and to consistently get yields that will support you and your family, that is incredibly difficult. And as the caller pointed out, this kind of lifestyle is not for everyone. It takes hard work and creativity and a kind of emotional and mental and psychological stability to be able to go out and do this day after day. It's really not easy.
And there is a capacity issue, as you alluded to earlier. I mean, you don't have conflict right now. Your uncle doesn't necessarily, maybe he does have fights over... Hey, this is my place to get leeches.
There are always fights over
are there?
Like that. Absolutely.
My thought was that if it got any more populist, you could have that, but maybe it already exists.
Oh, yeah, it already exists. Like any sort of people treated leeching in the 1980s as though it were a kind of gold rush, black gold, that these lakes were full of money, basically. And so people who don't have money are going to go and try and get it by hook or by crook. Just like when people say there's gold in them hills, mm-hmm. It's not an orderly sort of civil progression toward the gold mines where everyone sort of in a rational fashion sort of extracts the gold and shares. Gold rushes don't work that way. Mm-hmm. Oil booms don't work that way.
Yeah.
And so why should leeches work any different? There's always competition.
Leech rushes. Don't work that way.
Yeah.
Question from John in Minneapolis wonders if living off the land can be used to actually lift yourself off out of poverty. He's wondering about everyone in the country, not just on tribal land.
Can everyone do it? No way.
Yeah.
There'd be nothing left.
Again, because of the capacity issue.
Sure. And there's 300 million people in the United States.
Well, and how many million of them are in poverty would be the... to that direct question.
We could probably safely guess maybe 60 million, 80 million.
You know, my freezer is full of fish and deer and moose and rabbits and walleyes. It really offsets the grocery bill.
It does. Yeah. But you've always had, you're such a hard worker, Dennis, you've always had a job as well. The reason why you have a freezer in a house is because you have a job that pays the mortgage and pays the electric bill. And if you didn't have that, there'd be no electricity for the freezer or no house in which for the freezer to be in. And so no place for your fish.
Well, that was on purpose.
So they can work together. But I think the simple answer is I don't think that that subsistence living can lift a tremendous number of people out of poverty. Mm-hmm. I think that harvesting from the land can help soften the edges of poverty. Mm. I think it can, as a lifestyle, create both community and physical health. This kind of harvesting is taxing. You're getting a lot of exercise when you're pulling leech traps, when you're picking boughs, when you're picking cones, when you're setting traps for fur, when you're hunting, you're out in the woods, you're moving around, you're getting lots of exercise. So it can add in many ways, it can help blunt the kinds of difficulties that poverty really presents a lot of people, native and non. But I don't think it's the answer to poverty.
It's a cautionary tale, too.
Yeah, well, I think the answer to poverty is sort of some sort of structural rehabilitation of the American public. Mm-hmm. I think that's the answer to poverty.
And the word subsistence, just using the word subsistence, doesn't mean being rich. It's being subsistent. It's to make it to the next day.
Just to make a little bit. Yeah, to make it.
But you also talk, and this was interesting to me too, because your Uncle Bobby is the example, that there are structures, for example, in tribal government, and there are efforts to help with the unemployment of 60% on a place like Leech Lake that are in place for people like your uncle. And you question whether those structures need a little retooling as well, maybe just in general or within the prism of this kind of living off the land.
I mean, just speaking about, tribal efforts to help tribal members in different places, there's been, since the late 1980s, there's been in many places an almost single-minded focus on gaming as the answer to tribal poverty. Gaming has helped in many ways, but there's no single answer to addressing or to eradicating systemic poverty in Native communities. Now tribes are beginning, but I think they could even do more, beginning to think outside of the gaming box at other ways that tribal members can be helped to make ends meet. Subsistence is one way. To me, it's sort of a sensible way. Native folk have always lived in some relation with nature. Of course, all people have. All people do.
Sure.
But we live in a remote rural area. There are few people and there are lots of trees. And that seems like it would make sense for the tribe to get into the subsistence game a little bit more. It also makes cultural and spiritual sense, as Dennis points out. Mm-hmm. So, but I don't think that's the answer for the tribe. But, any more than gaming was the answer either.
John on Twitter here wonders about urbanites. How would we start down this path of any form? Maybe it's cautionary. Maybe it's just a matter of biking more to work. I don't know. But where does living off the land play in urban settings?
That's a really good question. I mean, Dennis, a lot of your students are urban. You're urban now.
So they come to your camp for the week or two, but then they go back home. And
I think it's the ideal lifestyle, living two lifestyles. That's being bilingual, bicultural, just living two lifestyles.
That works
for
you.
When I'm tired of living in the woods, I come to the city. When I'm tired of living in the city, I go to the woods.
Yeah. I'm urban now, too.
You are?
Sure.
Yeah, you live in L.A.
Yeah, I live in Los Angeles. And it presents some difficulties. But, my life is built around, I guess, my profession in some ways, which is a teacher and a writer. But it's also built around my tribe, too. So I always go back and we sugar. I always go back and we hunt. And the two, as Dennis points out, kind of, for me, work really well together. Could I live my life as only a hunter and a cone picker and a trapper?
Not in L.A.
Not in L.A., for sure. And even up here, it would be a hard life. Mm-hmm. Am I good enough to make it? It's never been tested. I learned to trap from Dennis's family. Mm-hmm. They taught me pretty much everything I know about trapping.
His mom, his uncle Jim Banks, his brother Dan, his brother Don from Dennis himself. So I've had great teachers, but I don't think I'd make it.
You know, yes, we've talked a lot about the romanticism, but also the not romanticism of what we're talking about here. But you alluded to it a moment ago with poverty, this idea that, no, it won't really pull a lot of people out of poverty, but it could soften the edges. But there are other things people do when they don't have money, David, that are destructive.
Like what?
Well, they join a gang, that's a problem, right? I mean, isn't that another side of the coin of trying to figure out how to make a go of it in this world?
They join a gang. They sell drugs. Sure.
Your own uncle had some issues, I think.
He did, back in the day, a long time ago.
So I wonder if this is being presented as a, no, it's not for everyone, but hey, there are other options out there kind of a thing.
I think that's the best way to put it. I mean, what I noticed when I was talking to people who, this is interesting, right? This makes subsistence very much like wage labor or like having a profession, that in order to hold down a job, any job, right, you have to be somewhat emotionally stable. You have to have a work ethic. You have to have a kind of a rhythm in your life, It can't be full of chaos and disruption, and you can't change direction all the time. You'll get fired. You won't get hired. You won't have a profession or a job. Subsistence is no different. If you're busy, if you're in and out of treatment, or you're fighting with your spouse, you're going to miss the wild rice harvest, because the wild rice won't wait for you. It gets ripe at a certain time. And if you're in the clink for a DWI or you're in treatment, you're going to miss it and you're going to get out. You're not going to have any rice. So even subsistence takes a kind of, it requires a certain kind of mental health.
Mm-hmm. Discipline. Really.
And discipline. It's just the way that a job like being a radio host or a professor or a language teacher takes. And but it is, as you point out, to me, a really healthy alternative. I think subsistence living, even if you don't make your entire living doing it, it puts you in the woods. I think that's a good thing. It gets you moving. I think that's a good thing. It puts you in touch with people of incredible creativity and passion and deep, deep knowledge, like Dennis's mother, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
So I think of it as value positive. Is it the answer? Of course not, but it's an answer.
I want to spend actually a few minutes here at the end of our hour. I'm just curious, because tomorrow, David, is Thanksgiving. How are you, or are you not, marking that holiday?
Well, I should say it's Thanksgiving for a lot of people, but for people like Dennis and me, it's your welcome day.
Say more.
It's not Thanksgiving Day. You're welcome.
That's a good one.
That's why I brought it up. You're welcome. And,
so to all the listeners, I'd like to wish you a very happy You're Welcome Day tomorrow. And I'm celebrating it with Dennis.
Yeah. Originally, Thanksgiving, came from the Ojibwe. And in my classes, I used to teach that everything came from the Ojibwe.
There's no Ojibwe centrism in this room.
It's the original fall ceremony. People gather and they give thanks for our harvest.
Yeah.
So it's Ojibwe nature all around.
And what we're not saying out loud, but we should clarify, it's not the joyful holiday for Indian country necessarily.
Well, it is if you're a native person who loves football, But we're going to spend it eating some really good food. And, I know that we'll spend it thinking about, the harvesting that we did. I brought Dennis some deer meat down from up north, and I know we're going to eat that tonight and tomorrow as well.
Definitely.
And so...
And the lake trout that we caught from Skadigun.
Oh, lake trout. I wasn't on that trip. That's such a fish. But we're going to eat that too. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know about other people, but, native people gather like everyone else and are thankful for our continued existence. To be sure. And I think about how grateful I am to have sort of lived a life that put me in touch with people like my Uncle Bobby, like Dennis, like other people like that who've taught me a tremendous amount about a way of life that I wouldn't know anything about if I hadn't met them. So that's how I'm going to spend it.
And final note, you have another book coming out, Prudence?
Yeah.
Is it fiction or not?
It's fiction. I have a novel coming out in February.
Back to fiction then.
It's going to be on and off years, I think, you know, fiction, nonfiction. I think that's sort of the pattern that my life is taking. But it's a novel, and it's a World War II novel, something of a love story which goes horribly awry.
Does it have a setting in Indian country?
Yeah, northern Minnesota.
All right.
During World War II.
During World War II. The book is called Prudence. So that's February, so we'll have to
February.
Have you back.
You have to wait a little bit.
We'll have to wait a little bit, but we'll have you back on to talk about that
as
well.
Super. Thanks.
This has been very interesting, and I really enjoyed the conversation here. So thank you very much, both of you. Dennis Jones, formerly of the University of Minnesota, retired earlier this year, but still have your camp, your immersion camp in Ontario. Thanks for being here, Dennis.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to be doing in my retirement.
And David Troyer, the article we're talking about in Harper's Magazine, is online. We have it at nprnews.org. Happy Your Welcome Day, David.
And happy Your Welcome Day to you, too.
Right on.
And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
This is The Daily Circuit.